Right, joining me in the line today is Randy Alcorn. He is the founder and the director of Eternal Perspective Ministries. It's a nonprofit organization, and he is also the best-selling author of over 35 books, including his latest book, Managing God's Money, A Biblical Guide. Randy, thank you so much for joining me on Follow the Money Weekly Radio.
You're welcome. Great to be with you.
I have really enjoyed your books over the years, and the two that really have had the biggest impact on me personally would be Money, Possessions, and Eternity, and also the book that many people are aware of. It's a little gift book size. It's called The Treasure Principle. That's a very small book, very thin book, but it makes a whole lot of sense. And the topic of it is basically giving. It's charitable giving. And in a minute, I want to talk about your work. I want to talk about your latest book, hot off the press, just came out this month, Managing God's Money. But first, I have found the story of your personal life to be very interesting. Two decades ago, you were a pastor at a very large church. You were extremely active in the pro-life movement, and I act as if you were. You still are. But then something happened that would change your life forever. Randy, share with our audience about those days and how they led you to where you are today.
Well, as you say, I was pastoring back in the 1980s. Our church was growing in the mid-1980s. We opened our home to a girl who was pregnant, helped her place her child for adoption into a Christian home, developed a real concern for women in crisis pregnancies, these unmarried girls, and not knowing what to do, and many of them getting abortions and then regretting it the rest of their lives. And so we had a real heart for the women, and then we also had a heart for the children who were dying from abortion. And then as a pastor, I started speaking more often about it. Then in the late 1980s, 1989, the rescue movement was going on, civil disobedience at abortion clinics, and like a number of other pastors, I felt very led of God to do this, even though I didn't want to do it, to go down to the abortion clinics and to peacefully, nonviolently stand in front of the clinics, impeding access and speaking up for those who cannot speak for themselves, defending the rights of the poor and needy, as Scripture says. Never believed that everybody else was called to do that, just believed that we were called to do that. With that call came a lot of difficulty, particularly when you lived in Oregon. There were some parts of the country where, some parts of the Bible Belt where this was at least respected by a number of church people, that this was a legitimate thing to do. Let's just say that the climate in the state of Oregon, a very liberal state, and we have homosexual protesters, environmentalist protesters, and that's one thing. But to actually stand up on behalf of unborn babies was just considered to be utterly unacceptable, and so the judges would hammer us in the courts and all. So I went through several lawsuits, and one in particular where the result was that they had awarded the abortion clinic we'd been standing in front of compensatory damages that were not for any damage of property, because there's nothing like that, but just simply for the number of abortions we had prevented that day, we were to pay them and pay their attorney for, his fees, of course. And by the time we were done with that, we, of course, lost that case, because as their attorney eloquently argued in court, it is just as legal for these people to perform abortions as it is for McDonald's to sell hamburgers. And technically, legally, he's right. Well, I told a judge that I would pay anybody anything that I owed them. I mean, I had written Money, Possessions, Eternity. I believe absolutely in financial integrity. I said, but one thing I will not do is write out a check to an abortion clinic. They will use the money to kill children. That's what they do. So essentially, I was saying, if you want them to have it, you're going to have to take it from me. So then there was, I didn't say it in those terms, of course, but then there was then a court order to garnish my wages as a pastor and take the money, my portion of the money, out of my monthly income and give it to the abortion clinic. And as soon as I heard that was being done, I resigned as a pastor. The church paid me what they owed me. And then under Oregon law, if you make minimum wage, you cannot be garnished. Anything that you make, because it's considered subsistence wage, anything you make above that can be garnished under law. And so we committed ourselves to make no more than minimum wage, because that way the abortion clinic couldn't get any of it. And we're now a little over 20 years later, and by God's grace, the abortion clinic never did get any of it, and we thank God for that.
So you live off of minimum wage right now, still to this day?
That's right, to this day. There's the possibility, we just had our annual board meeting, there's the possibility now that we've gone over 20 years that we may be free to change that because of how long a judgment is effective and all of that. But that's in the works, but for now I'm still making minimum wage.
Just something, just really something. And I imagine, obviously, that had some that had to have some sort of impact on your idea of money, possessions, eternity. And really what you do in much of your work is you point to the fact that money is important, not just to us, not just to our well-being, but you also point out that many times this isn't pointed out very much, especially in secular circles, that money is important to God. And for some listening today, they may be wondering why God would care a lick about their money. Why does God care about the way we use money, Randy?
Well, money is important to God because it represents our priorities, our life values, our worldview. And Jesus said, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. In other words, where you put your money, your heart will follow. Now notice, he didn't say that where your heart is, your treasures will go. That would probably make more sense to us. And in a sense, of course, that's true. I mean, if my heart is really into something, then I'll put my money there. If my heart is really into a particular company, I'll invest in that company. If my heart is really in missions in India, I'll invest in missions in India. So that part makes sense to us. But he actually reverses it. And sometimes I think we really miss the meaning of that. I was actually writing an article for a Christian magazine. Actually, it was a chapter in a book. And I put that thing where your heart follows your money. And then the editor crossed it out and put your money follows your heart. And I'm going, well, yeah, except that's not what Jesus is saying. He's saying where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Your heart follows your money. And that's so important to God because obviously he's concerned about our hearts. He says, love the Lord your God with all your heart and mind and soul and strength, you know. But the heart in Scripture, we're told in Proverbs, guard your heart, for in it are the wellsprings of life. You know, our heart is fundamentally important to God. That's our orientation of our lives. That's what's important to us. That's what we care about. So the reason God cares about money is that money is a test for where our heart is and an opportunity to determine where our heart goes. Because the more you invest in, for instance, God's kingdom, the more you will have, by definition, what? Vested interest in God's kingdom. And I remember I had this experience many years ago. My wife and I, this is long before the pro-life work and the lawsuits and all of that, but my wife and I were discovering that, you know, we had a great heart for missions when we were in Bible college. And I led a Pray for China missions prayer group and all kinds of things. And we considered the mission field. And, well, we ended up in pastoral ministry, and that was fine. But we were talking about, you know, we just don't have the heart that we once had for missions. And so what did we do? Well, based upon what Matthew 6 says, we determine we are going to give more and more of our money, which is really God's money entrusted to our care, and we're going to invest it in world missions. And you know what happened? We got back our heart for missions and then some, because the more you invest money in something, the greater your vested interest in it. Whether it's missions or whether it's a new house or a second home or a new car, wherever you put your money, your heart is going to follow.
Yes, one of the things we do, Randy, here at our organization, and we have a five-tiered level approach to financial independence. The very first level involves creating a charitable giving plan. People are familiar with financial plans, and we encourage those. It's important to have a plan in anything, especially with your money. But when it comes to giving, many times people just kind of approach that, here it's Sunday morning, I'm at church here, I'll pay off the pastor. You know, it's a real quick, let's write out the check, let's figure out what 10% is. But instead, actually coming up with a dream, this is obviously how I want to retire. This is part of my financial plan. Here's what I dream for my children. I want to send them to this college. But then we go a step further and say, before you even dream about any of that, start by dreaming, what do you want to do as far as giving? You know, what are your dreams there? And that can really change your whole approach as you go forward.
Absolutely. I think what you said is absolutely true. I mean, when you make giving a priority, part of your plan, as you put it so well, that makes all the difference. Because what so many people do is they get inspired to give. Maybe they'll hear the pastor preach on it. Maybe they'll read my book, The Treasure Principle, or one of the other books that's out there. But then they get perhaps inspired, motivated, and their intention is, okay, I got to do more giving. But what do? Well, they wait till the end of the month and see if there's something left. You know, and then if there is, they happen to be in church at the time, or, you know, happen to get something in the mail that requests support for something that's going on somewhere in the world, then they'll give an amount, and often that's a token amount. If you wait to see what's left, number one, usually there won't be anything left. But even if there is something left, you'll be thinking, yeah, but what about this? What about that? Whereas if you do your giving up front, and that's the plan, that's what the plan will do for you. The plan says, I am going to give this much, not I'm going to wait to see if something's left. I'm going to give this much. And that's like the first fruits in the Bible. First fruits. The greatest thing about the first fruits is what it sounds like. You take the first portion, give that back to God. So you're never waiting to see if something's left. Now, by all means, give the first fruits, do your plan to giving, and if at the end of the month, the end of the year, or the end of anything, there is more left and God moves your heart, by all means, add that onto your giving. That's a great thing, but plan your giving up front. I think that's great.
You know, I think, Randy, when people hear the topic of money and they hear the topic of God, religion, whatever, they start to think what they see on late night TV. I mean, you know, you're sitting on the couch at night, you flip on the TV, and of course you got some infomercials, and then you also have these late night television ministries that encourage people to send in their best gift, and then, you know, be sure that they pray over it, and then God's going to miraculously give them. And then, of course, you see testimonials, somebody saying, oh, God gave me a new job, God gave me a new car, God gave me a new house. What's up with this, Randy? What's your view on the idea of giving to get? How do you feel about it?
Well, giving to get is just plain biblically wrong. Now, there is a half-truth behind almost every believable heresy, and that's what makes it dangerous. Scripture certainly does say in Malachi 3, an often quoted passage, you know, that, hey, bring in your tithes and offerings, and notice it's not just tithes. People often say, well, in the Old Testament it was tithe, in the New Testament it's free will offerings. No, in the Old Testament, free will offerings were a very common part of what they did, and said, don't rob God by withholding your tithes and your free will offerings, which meant that you could actually rob God, you could tithe and still rob God, because he's leading you to give these free will offerings and you're holding back on them. But that passage says, but no, go ahead, don't withhold, do the tithe, do the free will offering and watch what God is going to do. He's going to fill your barns. He's going to bless you. And this is an appeal back to Deuteronomy in terms of the blessings and the curse, and generosity is blessed and stinginess is cursed. It's an appeal to Proverbs, you know, wisdom and foolishness. The wise thing to do is to be generous. The foolish thing to do is to be stingy. And that's a great principle, but it's not a set in stone promise that if you do this much, God will bless you exactly this much, because there is such a thing as sacrificial giving. It would not be sacrificial if it all automatically, all the time, comes back to you. And so, yes, the poor widow gives everything she has, and God, we know, takes care of her the next day, but it does not mean that the poor widow became the wealthy widow. And certainly then you see that in the New Testament also. You see Jesus in Luke 6 saying that in the measure you give, so it will be given back to you, and it'll be flowing over, spilling out of your lap. So some people go, that's the key to prosperity, is if I just give this away, then I'll get this much back, the hundredfold blessing and all of that. Well, we see the Macedonian Christians in 2 Corinthians 8, and we're told that they live in extreme poverty, but in their great generosity, they have given way beyond, above and beyond their means. Now, does it say that the poor Macedonians who live in actually extreme poverty are no longer poor? No. They're sacrificially giving, and God will indeed bless them. But the blessings are often in the form of personal contentment, joy, knowing that you have invested in eternity, knowing, yes, that God will still take care of you, and knowing great is your reward in heaven, which Jesus says in Luke 6, you're blessed when people persecute you and speak evil against you, and blessed are the poor. Well, why? Because great is your reward in heaven. So that's the shortcoming of prosperity theology. There is truth to God is going to ultimately give his children health and wealth. It's in heaven. It's in the resurrection. You can count on it. You're going to be healthy, and you're going to be wealthy in the sense of having all that you need for all eternity. But in this life, God calls us to be faithful people who give sacrificially, and it doesn't mean if you give sacrificially that your business will never lose money. It doesn't mean your house will never burn down. There just are not those kind of guarantees attached to the treasures of this life. What we're promised is that we're laying up for ourselves treasures in heaven that will be enjoyed in the form of eternal reward in the life to come.
Our guest today is Randy Alcorn. He is the author of several books, including his latest, Managing God's Money, A Biblical Guide. Randy, you make some great points, and I think about this eternal perspective that you're talking about. Of course, your ministry even has that in its title, but the idea of thinking about something past now, and I tell you what, to get, I don't care, if it's, who in America, trying to get them to think past right now is difficult. We have media, we have advertisers, we have financial institutions, we have corporations all just cornering the consumer, urging him in every way, shape, and form with the full force of massive million-dollar budgets, telling every single consumer out there, buy now, buy now, buy now, you need this, you need that. And that's one of the other topics that you confront head on in your work, is that topic of overconsumption. You call it the possession obsession. We all know people who take comfort in shopping or buying something that they don't need with money they don't have. So, but we know that obviously coming from that leads to, of course, debt. But there's even a darker side that you talk about in your work. You talk about the dangers of materialism. Talk about those. What are some of those?
Materialism is a form of idolatry. It's making money into God. And like all forms of idolatry, it has tremendous implications. One is it makes the spiritual life waste away, or it surrounds the spiritual life with the values of materialism. And again, that's what you see in health and wealth gospel. That's what you see in prosperity theology. Because what these men usually are doing is they're saying, okay, you're going to get this payoff. That's materialism, but we've put it into the Christian realm. You're going to get this payoff here and now from your giving, and you're going to get 10 times more back. Well, if they really believe that, why don't they take everything that's given to them, which is paying their incredible salaries and paying for their jets, and why don't they give it away so that they would have 10 times more? You know, well, that's not what they do. They take what other people sacrificially give to them, and sure, they probably give some personally in their own lives, but they certainly don't do what they're calling upon other people to do in terms of the level of sacrifice, because they're not living sacrificial lifestyles. That's just... is they're flying around their jets and they're going on their vacations and wearing their jewelry that's evident on the television camera. And all, you know, as they're doing that, that's not where their values are. So what they've done is they've co-opted the secular worldview of materialism, and they've put Bible verses with it. And this is what happens to us, even if it's not health and wealth gospel per se. Materialism taints our lives. It hinders, can even destroy our spiritual lives. And in managing God's money, I give several examples of that from Scripture. And the thing is, materialism, it's like what Jeremiah talks about, is a broken cistern that can't hold water. It will never satisfy, so it's like a drug addiction. You know, the more you do it, the worse it gets and the less it satisfies. And really, that's repeatedly stated in the book of Ecclesiastes. Look at Solomon. It brought him no satisfaction. He said, "The sleep of the laborer is sweet, but the abundance of the rich man permits him no sleep." And the more you have, the more you have to worry about. Unhappiness, anxiety, futility. And then what materialism does, because it's this false god, it not only keeps you from enjoying the person of God in whom are all the great blessings, because he's the source of them all, but it obscures many of life's greatest blessings right now, because the person who's wrapped up in the money god doesn't take the time to love and enjoy his small children, the walk in the park, the flowers, the petting the dog, all of the kind of little blessings of life. And of course, materialism can always lead to pride and kind of an elitist attitude and the destruction of the family. And I'll just finish with that one, because there are many more, but I'll finish with that one because how many people have we both known who have spent their lives making money and building this dream house for their family, and by the time the dream house is built, the family has been broken up, and they're either living alone in that dream house, or their family's living in that dream house and they're living alone in an apartment somewhere, because they sacrificed God's dreams, the great dreams, the Christ-centered, family-centered dreams, for the lesser dream of materialism.
You make a great point. You know, the fact that it doesn't just take an abundance of material possessions around you to show that you have the love of money operating inside of you, but people who don't even really necessarily have anything, they just simply just hoard. Yeah. How about the opposite? What about people who are disguising their hoarding as investing? What about that, Tom?
I think that happens a lot. I think you can disguise hoarding as investing, and the hoarding mentality is very different than the careful planning mentality. Proverbs advocates a careful planning mentality. It says that, you know, basically the sluggard or the lazy man takes no concern for the future, but the righteous man looks ahead, foresees what is coming. You see that in Joseph, certainly. Now, in that case, it was actually revealed to him what was going to happen with the famine and the 7 years and, you know, the storing up for that. But I think for the individual Christian life, we should say that it is reasonable to have a savings account. It is reasonable to have something there for you to draw from When the surprise comes along, something to avoid you from going into debt, you know, the statistics about how close to bankruptcy the average American lives, and certainly how close to even greater indebtedness, and debts just become routine, you know, for us. But for the hoarder, he's just thinking that there's never enough. I mean, I talked to a woman who lives in Florida, and her husband was quite wealthy, and she was telling me a personal story about the women at this wonderful, beautiful, even luxurious retirement center, and their husbands were wealthy, they have a great amount of wealth, and she says, you can't believe this, but we will sit down, and our conversations are always about what she calls the bag lady syndrome, which is, well, if we gave away some of these, in some cases, millions and millions of dollars that is sitting there in assets and bank accounts, then we could end up out on the streets. And she said, it's really, they're not kidding. They're really actually thinking they're in danger of being out there. Well, that's a hoarding mentality that appeals to one's insecurity. For the Christian, it needs to be what we see in Matthew 6, which is trusting God when Jesus says, be anxious for nothing. I mean, do not worry, because God is going to take care of you. And you put the kingdom of God first and his righteousness, and these things will be added to you. What? Luxury? No, but God's faithful provision.
Randy, how much money that your ministry gets every year, how much are you giving away?
Well, we give away the minimum of 100% of the royalties that come in, which means we've given away over $5 million in the last number of years, because the royalties have been over $5 million. So we give away all the royalties. Then we give away more in addition to that. We kind of consider the royalties to be our minimal commitment, and the funny thing is our overall operating budget, I should know this, I was in a board meeting yesterday, you know, you'd think I'd pay better attention, but I think our overall operating budget is somewhere in the $300,000 range with our 11 or 12 employees or whatever it is, but the amount we give away each year is considerably larger than that. Now, some people have said, and this is obvious, well, why don't you just keep the royalties, spend them on your ministry, you'd still have millions of dollars to give away beyond that, and you wouldn't have to have people support you financially. And it's a decision we made years ago because we said, no, we want, number one, we want people's prayers. And it's exactly what we're saying about vested interests. If we don't need for people to give to this ministry, then if they're not giving, they're not going to be praying. Now, there are some people who pray without giving, of course, and that's wonderful. We love that. But the fact is that if people are going to invest in this ministry, then we have some sense of not only their prayer and support, but accountability. It's like they're thinking, okay, what are you doing with the money that we're giving? So we're able to tell them. And it just keeps us on our toes, and it also keeps us from presuming. And we want to model giving away the majority of our income in order to honor God, and then it's up to him if he chooses to provide. And we've had a few cutbacks in our ministry over the years from time to time, and that's been fine, and we've always said, sure, we could keep some royalties, but that's not what we want to do. And we believe God has been honored in that. And I don't mean that's a model for everybody else to do. I'm just saying that that's what we've done, and it has been glorious. And every time one of my books sells, and I get back the over 5 million books that have sold, and books on the bestsellers list or whatever, and when I look at it, it's very humbling, because I say to myself, okay, I'm glad that this book is selling well, and I'm glad God has touched many hearts through it. But it's also true that God may be selling this book just to raise some money for kingdom projects that are close to his heart, because that's where all the royalties are going to. And I love that.
Randy, how do you respond to the thoughts that inevitably have to come into your mind occasionally, that when you think about the money that you're giving away and all the money that you've made through these books and how successful you've sold, you know, over 5 million copies of your books, your books are all around the world. You've done fantastic job of spreading this message around the globe. What do you do? And I think this will help people who are listening. What do you do whenever the thought enters your mind, gosh, I could have had all that money myself. I could have really had a really, you know, luxurious home. I could have really done a lot of things. You're making minimum wage right now. What do you do when those thoughts enter your mind? How do you respond to them? What keeps you going and looking positive? Is it the eternal perspective?
Well, I can honestly say that we are content. And you see Paul talking about that in Philippians. But sometimes, you know, you'll go to a verse of scripture and you'll try to claim something that you're really not feeling. And that's fine. That's, you know, good. You know, but, and so some people might go to Philippians talking about contentment and sort of try to claim that, even though inside they're really struggling because they wish they had more money. I think in our case, over the period of the last 20 years, it's become a lifestyle, and we've seen God's provision, and so certainly nobody should feel sorry for us. The ministry provides each of us a used car to drive, my wife and I, and she's also employed by the ministry, and between my minimum wage salary and her part-time salary, you know, we've got, our income would be a lower middle class income, but our children are out of the home and our house was paid for, which was another decision we were very grateful for. Our house, literally, we paid off our house. It was a 30-year loan. We paid it off in 15 years, and it was 6 weeks before the judgment came against us and I had to resign and make minimum wage. So God had that plan, you know, all along. But anyway, we do fine. But let me give you one illustration that relates to your question. My daughter, Angela, when she was a teenager, she and I were out riding bikes one day. And we went down this new neighborhood close to where we live, maybe just a mile from where we live. And here was a brand new house that had just been built. And by Oregon standards, in our part of Oregon, it was unbelievably, it was, I mean, the selling price for the house was $600,000, which in some parts of the country doesn't get that huge of a house. In our area, gets an incredible house. Well, especially it did, you know, 15 years ago or whenever it is that I'm talking about. Okay, so anyway, we're looking at it, and she's talking about, look at that, and look at that yard, and look at what the, and I got, yeah, that is a beautiful house. We're both admiring it. And then I looked at her, and I said, you know, sweetheart, with the amount of money that came in royalties in the last 2 years, we could have paid cash and bought that house outright. Now, the royalties are higher now than they were then, but, you know, a couple of years with the royalties would have bought that house. And I said, do you wish we would have done that instead of doing what we have done with it in terms of giving it away? She looked at me and she laughed. And she said, Dad, it's just a house. And it just struck me, because she's so into, to this day, as married, mother of two, you know, 29 years old now, leading Bible studies with young women, and she is a mentor for others, an example for others, and she lives by the values that, by God's grace, we were able to raise her with. And it meant so much to me that she immediately saw that, yeah, we can say this is a nice house, but we wouldn't choose to live there, even though we could.
It's really refreshing to hear that, Randy. And it makes me wonder, we have a lot of pastors who listen to this program each and every week. Some of those pastors who are listening, they're hearing the words you're saying. They're certainly identifying some of the problems in their own churches. They see the materialism that's not just creeping in. I mean, it's just burst down the door. It's everywhere. Materialism is run amok. The consumerism, the overconsumption, the deception is just so ripe. And to the pastor who's out there, who's leading a congregation, who feels helpless in the face of this, what words of wisdom would you have to a pastor?
One thing I would say to pastors is, first, live it out yourself. Model what it is to live reasonably modestly, to live below your income, to not buy a house over your head, to not tie up so much of your life in house payments, to not have to buy the new car and the really nice new car, to not have to try to keep up with, so you won't stick out, the level that many people in your congregation are living at. How about instead you live more modestly, give more generously, and if anything, you do stick out? Because shouldn't a pastor stick out? I mean, shouldn't a pastor stick out in terms of his study of the Word, in terms of his prayer life? Shouldn't he stick out in terms of how he treats his wife and how he raises his children and the values of his home? I mean, if your goal is to not stick out and be any different, then you shouldn't be a pastor. I mean, as a pastor, it's an opportunity to model a way of thinking, a worldview, and a way of living that brings honor to the Lord and provides a model alternative to what people get in the culture. See, when the world looks at the church and sees that the church offers the same as the world does, well, you know, an unholy world is never going to be led to Christ by an unholy church. And a less than sanctified believer is never going to be led on to raise the bar of Christian giving and Christian living by other unsanctified believers. Somebody has to be the model and step forward. And one of the things I say to pastors is, get together some of the people in your church who have caught the vision of giving and living below their means. Get them together. And sometimes these will be missions-oriented people, and get them together for prayer and fellowship and like-mindedness to raise the bar for each other, but to then begin to strategize, how can we make a difference in our church? How can we, in ways that are humble, self-effacing, not drawing attention to ourselves, but how can we mentor younger people, and for that matter, older people, in generous giving and a lifestyle that's honoring to Christ in light of world need? And it's remarkable how far that can go in a church. Because, see, you know, we have people come, stand up, give their testimonies about how God has changed their family. And my marriage used to be this, but God has brought great healing to us. We were on the verge of divorce, and here's what God did. So what are you doing? You're telling the story of God's faithfulness in your marriage. What about parenting? Oh, we had neglected our kids, but, you know, this happened, and we said, no, we're losing our children. We're going to get involved in their lives. And yeah, it was tough, and we wish we would have been consistent since they were kids. But here's what God has done to rescue our family. We have people give testimonies about the missions trips they've taken, even about their prayer life. Here's what God has taught me about prayer. Here's what God has taught me about Bible study. Okay, why don't we do that with giving? Oh, but there's an answer. People say, yeah, but Matthew 6 says, don't do your giving before men in order to be seen by them. Right, but the same passage says the same about prayer, that says the same about fasting, and those aren't the only spiritual disciplines. Everything it says also applies to Bible study and your marriage and, you know, parenting and everything else. The point is, don't do this in order to be seen by men. If you're doing your giving so you can stand up and say, God has taught me lessons about giving, then you're not going to have a reward. You're doing it for the wrong reasons. But giving, like every other spiritual discipline, is something which we should be able to humbly, in a Christ-centered way, say, here's what we have learned about living a reasonable lifestyle, about having more money to give, about getting out of debt so that we could give more. Not just to be out of debt, but so we could give more to God's kingdom. And we need to have those testimonies of generous giving. We have prayer warriors in the church. We know who the prayer warriors are. I do. I know who to ask to pray for me. Okay, well, prayer's in that same passage in Matthew 6. We think it's fine to know who the prayer warriors are. Well, where are the giving warriors? Let's go to them. Let's at least let it be known there are some in our church, and if a young person or any person wants to be mentored by them, the pastor has some names, or somebody has some names, you can sit down with these people and they'll joyfully talk to you about living a Christ-centered lifestyle and giving more generously.
You know, the state of the church, Randy, is a little dismal right now as we look forward. We see the fact that many of the baby boomers are obviously retiring, and then eventually they're not going to be around any longer. And they have really been, and of course the older generation, even their parents, really built the current American church. They built it from the ground up. They made it what it is. These mega churches that litter the country all across the place, we see have been built on number one on loans, but number two on the good giving of good Christians. And we see a new generation that's popping up that doesn't quite catch the vision on giving. They certainly aren't giving like their parents are. This economic crisis has even caused giving at churches to go down as well. Just break out your crystal ball here for a minute and take a look about 20 to 30 years down the road. If the Lord tarries, what do you see for the American church if the economy does not get better, and if do you think that the younger generation is going to catch this vision of giving? I know you want it to, but realistically, what do you see happening?
I think the main issue is not going to be the state of the economy. It's going to be the state of the heart. I think stingy people, people who haven't learned the joy of giving and the virtues of giving, are not going to give much in any economy, though obviously they'll give more, all things being equal, when there's more wealth out there. My major concern, reflecting on what you're saying, is that the younger generation is not being mentored in the discipline and joy of giving. And I don't consider that primarily their fault. I consider it the fault of those of us who are older, that we have failed sometimes to live out the life of giving. But in other cases, even if we've done so, it has been so cloaked, and sometimes we think we have that biblical basis for cloaking it, but that we are withholding. I've talked to parents who have withheld from their own children their giving habits. And certainly the children should be involved in this, but the thing that gives me great hope, despite the statistics, which are the younger someone is, the less of a generous giver they are, which goes against the grain of a lot of people's thinking. They're thinking of a younger generation that's very concerned about the poor and the needy. And the younger generation does tend to go out to soup kitchens and go out on the streets and talk with people. But statistically, the older you are, the larger proportion of your income you give. That's pretty much straight across the board. The younger you are, the less proportion you give. Obviously, the amounts are less, but, you know, because of income differences, but we're talking about proportion. But what I have found, and this is the part that gives me encouragement, is that if you give younger people the models they need, raise the bar for them, show them the joy and discipline of giving, if you mentor them in giving, then they will become givers. But if you just leave them alone, and that's what we've been doing in our churches, we've been counting on, you know, middle age and older people, and they've been generous and they're funding the church. Yes, but they're getting older and they're going to die, and then they're going to leave their wealth behind. And most of them, by the way, will not leave their wealth behind to the kingdom of God. They'll leave it to their children, who are already, in many cases, well taken care of with good jobs. You know, you got doctors, you got lawyers who are inheriting estates. Even a middle-class estate now is worth what used to be considered a fortune in many cases. And they're getting this, and what are they doing with it? In many cases, they're simply going to increase their own lifestyle. They don't know what else to do with it because they've never seen or heard the consistent models of giving. And so this is one of the reasons I say to parents, well, what would you want your already reasonably well-to-do children who are adults, what would you want them to do with all the estate that you're leaving them? And in many cases, they'll say, well, we'd want them to give it away. And I say, well, then why don't you give it away? You're the ones God has entrusted it to. But the most important thing we can give to our children is not the inheritance. The most important thing we can give them is the heritage of Christ-centered, godly, generous giving, a life that has been given away. Give them a model so that our grandchildren in turn have a model. And then if we're in any church where this is done, I am optimistic about the future in terms of giving and church income and the church's ability to do things. In any church where this isn't done, very honestly, I'm pessimistic.
Our guest is Randy Alcorn. He's the author of 35 books, including the most recent book, Managing God's Money, A Biblical Guide. Randy, we just have a few moments left. In the remaining time here, tell us about the brand new book that just came out, Managing God's Money. It's a very small, slim, or thin book, but it's actually 250 pages, and it goes into a lot of in-depth about what some of the stuff you've been talking about. Share with our audience what they can find in that book.
Well, Managing God's Money is a book that I have been wanting to write literally for 20 years, ever since I wrote the first edition of Money, Possessions, and Eternity, which was in 1989. Then I did a very thorough revision of it in 2004, 2005, something like that, an update. But I have always wanted to do a smaller book that dealt with the whole realm of Christian stewardship. The Treasure Principle is a smaller book. It sold over 1.5 million copies, but it's specifically on giving. And it includes God's ownership and some other stewardship, you know, related things. But Managing God's Money, a biblical guide, is written. The cookies are put down on a lower shelf. Everybody can understand it. It's challenging, and it deals with all of the issues from, insurance, inheritance, gambling, saving, debt, all of those types of practical things, but also lays a biblical foundation for the call of God as owner of all of our assets, and hence the title, Managing God's Money. Not managing your money. It isn't your money. It belongs to God. We are His money managers, and that theme of stewardship is woven throughout. And one of the other things I'm excited about this book for is it's got a substantial amount in it, even though it's a small book and covers a lot of ground, but the list price is only $5.99. And I really, in a day when books are very expensive, I wanted an inexpensive book, and at $5.99, even the pages look nice. Sometimes you get the mass market editions, and the pages are kind of hard to read. They're dark, and they got little flecks of wood in them, and and these are nice looking pages. I go, the publisher really pulled this off, and so for $5.99, I think it's a very great price on a book that I'm excited about, that I think God is going to use in a lot of people's lives.
Everybody can afford that, $5.99. That's really, really reasonable. All right. Well, listen, Randy, for those who might be listening who say, listen, I want to find out more about Randy. I want to find out more about his work. What's the best way for them to do so?
You can go to our website, which is epm.org, and EPM stands for Eternal Perspective Ministries. Or you could put my name, Randy Alcorn, into a Google search or whatever search engine you use, and you will be right toward the top, probably right at the top, will be our ministry website, EPM. Then I've got a Facebook page that's popular with a lot of people, where I post thoughts daily, and there's Twitter and the blog, and there's other stuff that you can connect with and deal with financially related issues and other issues as well.
Well, our guest has been Randy Alcorn. The book is Managing God's Money, A Biblical Guide. Randy, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure. Thanks for what you do.